Our first guest this hour is Martin Seligman, one of the creators of a new idea in science, positive psychology. You could call it the science of happiness. Dr. Seligman is a former president of the American Psychological Association. He's written more than 20 books, among them Learned Optimism, The Optimistic Child, and his latest, Authentic Happiness. Dr. Seligman, if I were to come to you and say, my life's been pretty good so far, no major disasters, things going all right, but here I am at midlife starting to wonder, is this all there is? Well, what would you say?
Well, you're asking just the right questions, Jim. So many of our fellows are sitting in the parking lot of life, feeling empty, feeling that, gee, maybe I'm fidgeting until I die. And so there becomes a serious scientific question about what do we know about happiness and how do we build it? And the way I parse the question is into three different kinds of happiness, of which common sense tells us there's only one. And the three are the pleasant life, the good life, and the meaningful life.
The pleasant life, the good life, and the meaningful life. They sound like pieces of the same thing.
Yeah, they're very different and in some ways opposite. Let me tell you how I think about each one of them. The pleasant life for us is the successful pursuit of pleasures, the joys, the ecstasies, the comforts, the mirths, the positive emotions that we can feel. But there's an important limitation of the pleasant life, and that is there's a normal distribution of the capacity to feel pleasure. And 50% of the population, by definition, is in the lower half of the capacity to feel pleasure. And those people, before positive psychology came along, were consigned to the hell of unhappiness. But it turns out that those people are not unhappy, that they often participate in the two other great forms of happiness, the good life and the meaningful life.
The pleasant life is, therefore, things that we individually find to enjoy. A good piece of music, a dinner that is completely satisfying, the physical things that we can proactively search out.
The sensory pleasures that when you look inside, you're conscious of really good internal feeling defines the pleasant life. And it turns out there are a whole bunch of ways of searching those things out and amplifying them. But it has two drawbacks, and one is that these things habituate very rapidly. Almost all music, like the taste of French vanilla ice cream, habituates. So the first taste of French vanilla ice cream is great. The second taste is a little worse. And by the fifth taste, for most people, it's like cardboard. And that's what you need to avoid with the pleasures. And it's not simple.
So you need to delay your pleasures sometimes?
Space them out. Vary them. There's a bunch of savoring techniques which are useful. Taking mental photographs, sharing them with another people, taking physical souvenirs. These are all amplifiers of the pleasant life, and there are a set of skills associated with keeping the pleasant life pleasant.
Let's talk about the good life then for a minute. This is a kind of happiness that the people who don't necessarily understand or appreciate the pleasant life can use to find happiness?
Basically, the good life consists in first knowing what your, I'm going to call them your highest strengths, your signature strengths are, and using them every day in work, in love, and play, and parenting. And what using your strengths leads to is a state of immersion, absorption, and flow. Time stops for you. You feel completely at home. And it's the opposite in many ways of the pleasant life, because what defines absorption and flow and time stopping is there's no feeling or thought at all. You're one with the music. And that's what the good life consists in.
How do you know what your strengths are? I mean, each of us would be probably willing to write down a few of the things that we think we're good at. But is that what you mean by strengths? And if not, how do you find them?
No, I mean something much more sophisticated than that, and that's why I wrote the book. And any of your listeners can, for free, go to the website, which is authentichappiness.org, and take a very enjoyable 20-minute test. And at the end of that test, it tells you, based on tens of thousands of people, what your five highest strengths are. And that's the first step in the good life. And the second step is learning to use them as frequently as possible. Let me just give you an example, Jim, of what I mean. One woman I know is a waitress, and She really hated being a waitress. She thought it was demeaning waiting on tables, lifting heavy trays and the like. And she took the test of strengths, and her highest strength was social intelligence. So I asked her, why don't you recraft your work to use your highest strength? So what she decided she would do is to make each encounter for her customers the social highlight of their evening. So she was able to transform her job from being demeaning, hanging heavy on her hands, to one in which time stopped for her. She loves doing it.
Can you tell me how you see the meaningful life differing from the first two?
Yes. It's knowing your signature strengths, but using them in the service of something much larger than you are. Losing the self, giving up the pleasant life very often for the sake of something larger.
I'm curious about an example, I guess, for the third. It seems to me that there was a study you did with two groups of students, and you had one group go out and do something that they really loved, and another group go out and do something that would make someone else feel good. Does that fall into the meaningful life?
No, let me say it more exactly. One of the positive psychology exercises that we do is to do something fun and do something altruistic or philanthropic. And we've seen quite a remarkable difference. So let me just give you one incident from this. One of my students went out and did something fun. I think it was hanging out with her friends. And what we find with the pleasant things, the fun things, is they have a square wave offset. When they're done, they're done. And then also in the same week, her third grade nephew called her up and needed tutoring in arithmetic. And she spent 2 hours on the phone tutoring him in arithmetic. And she reported, after that, the whole day went better. I was mellower. I could listen to people. People liked me more. And then one of my other students, a Wharton student, said, the remarkable thing about this exercise, doing something altruistic with doing something fun, I went to Wharton to make a lot of money. And the reason I wanted to make a lot of money, I thought it would give me happiness and freedom. And I found that I could be happier helping other people than I could shopping. That's the difference between the pleasant life and the meaningful life.
Again, it does sound as though in each of these cases there's been a kind of value judgment made that pursuing the pleasant life is a little like the Wall Street broker who makes a lot of money to buy another Mercedes, as opposed to the social worker who saves lives among the homeless.
Well, I think the important thing is not a value judgment, but basically what are its consequences for life satisfaction. And so as we measure life satisfaction, it turns out that people who engage in the meaningful life, people who may be very low on the Wall Street pleasure, are very satisfied in life. And it also turns out if you look at wealth, for example, and what the effect is of increased wealth, it turns out additional money makes almost no difference once you're above the safety net on life satisfaction. But meaning does, and the good life being absorbed does.
Are there things that you do, there techniques that you practice, tricks that you play yourself to pursue happiness?
I have to tell you a lizard story, which I think may illustrate the lack of shortcuts. When I was an undergraduate, one of my professors had this huge Amazonian lizard that someone gave him as a gift. And the problem about the lizard, it was starving to death. We couldn't figure out what it ate. And Julian brought in flies for the lizard, and the lizard rejected them. He blended mangoes and papayas, and the lizard rejected them. And the lizard was starving to death before our eyes. And one day Julian came in. He offered the lizard his lunch, which was a ham on rye, and the lizard rejected it. And he went about his business, read the New York Times, put it down on top of the ham sandwich. And from across the room, the lizard looked at this configuration, got up on its haunches, stalked over, jumped on the table, shredded the New York Times, and ate the ham sandwich. Now, what's going on here, Jim, is what I think the good life is about. We're a lot more complex than lizards. But like the lizard, we can't enjoy life unless we do the things, indulge the activities, the strengths and virtues that evolution has endowed us with to get the things we want. There is no shortcut for the lizard for eating, and there's no shortcut to flow, absorption, and immersion. It requires that you know what you're best at, and you use it all the time.
Martin Seligman is the author of Authentic Happiness. If you want to take his free signature strength survey, it's online at www.authentichappiness.org.